Hello, I'm Anna Maria Tremonti, and you are listening to The Current. We are in the middle of a discussion with Naomi Klein about her new book, The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. This is what makes your book so provocative and so disturbing. The idea that you don't just parallel the idea of torture and economic change. You draw a thick line between the two of them, and you do it again with Iraq. And I want to talk about that because you say Paul Bremer, who headed the Coalition Provisional Authority, imposed parallel restraints on liberties for economic purposes. What are you telling us about Iraq?
Well, I mean, this is one of the sort of fairy tales that we hear about this war, that the U.S. went to Iraq to bring democracy. And if we look at what happened in the key first year, Paul Bremer's year in Iraq, he had two main priorities. One was this attempt to radically restructure the economy, which we've talked about. And he was very open about, you know, announcing that the sell-off of Iraq's 200 state companies, for instance, imposing this 15% flat tax, which, you know, had first been tried in Chile and then in Russia and now in Iraq. So that was one side. And then the other side was an attempt to restrict democracy, to keep democracy from taking over and interfering with this economic project. Now, there are things that we've totally forgotten about what happened in that first year, like the mass demonstrations, 100,000 people on the streets of Baghdad shouting, yes, yes, elections, no, no, selections, because Iraqis wanted to vote in their first government and not have it appointed by the U.S. and not have the whole transition project managed.
Let's keep looking at what has happened economically in Iraq that maybe we've forgotten. The other thing was the ability of foreign-owned companies to go in and pull out profits.
Yeah, that was the foreign investment law that Paul Bremer wrote in September, just at the end of that summer, Order 39, which is really, at the time, The Economist described it as the wish list for foreign investors. There were absolutely no restrictions. As an incentive for foreign companies to come to Iraq, they were allowed to own 100% of Iraqi properties, and they could take 100% of the profits out, and they didn't have to hire local people. There were no, you know, quotas or anything like that. So it was the wish list. It was the true liberation of Iraq. It was just not for Iraqis.
Now, we've talked about torture. You're saying that torture was required to accomplish these economic changes, that, again, you draw a thick line between the torture we have heard about at Abu Ghraib and some of the torture we haven't heard a lot about that you talk about in your book, and these changes.
Well, I think torture in Iraq was not used right away by the U.S. occupation forces. The turning point was actually a famous memo that says it's time to take the gloves off, gentlemen, from a senior intelligence official in Iraq. But when you started to see the first documented cases, it was right after this economic restructuring. It was in October of 2004. And I mean, this is when the resistance was rising. So it's all interrelated, because part of Paul Bremer's economic restructuring was this attack on the public sector, which is always a key component of free market economic restructuring, of shock therapy, which in Iraq was called de-bathification. It was, first of all, the firing of the entire Iraqi army and allowing them to keep their weapons, and then just the wiping out the public sector. Anyone who was a member of the Ba'ath Party was fired. Now, I believe this went beyond de-Ba'athification, in that I think it was informed by how ideological the occupation was, because I think only someone who is a true sort of Milton Friedmanite could convince themselves that it would be possible to fire tens of thousands of skilled public servants and still have a functioning state. I mean, anyone who has just the slightest bit of respect for what public servants do could never believe for a minute that you wouldn't have both a breakdown of the public infrastructure and a huge amount of rage coming at you.
How does this play out with Hurricane Katrina?
Well, it's quite extraordinary, because if we remember what the real disaster is, you know, when you talk to people in New Orleans now, everyone will remind you that this city did not flood because it was hit by a hurricane. Everybody keeps blaming a hurricane, but New Orleans was not hit by a Category 5 hurricane or even a Category 4 hurricane. It was a Category 1 hurricane, or maybe a tropical storm. What it got hit with was crumbling infrastructure. It got hit with something I think we're going to see a lot more of in the future, which is a very dangerous combination of weak, brittle public infrastructure that has been steadily starved for 20 or so years, and the combination of heavy weather. And when that happens, that's when you get a disaster. So it was really a disaster created by ideology on many levels.
And in the wake of that?
Well, in the wake of that, you know, there was this moment, Anna Maria, where after that hit, there was a moment where it seemed like we might actually have a debate about this ideology that had failed so spectacularly when the levees broke and when the whole government system broke. Instead, it has been harnessed to really finish the job of destroying the public sector in New Orleans. So now, one of the most striking things I saw when I was there was these huge public housing projects that are quite intact, structurally intact. They sustain very little flood damage, and they've just been boarded up. And the people who live there, there's 5,000 units like this, where people could be moving back. And who are still dispersed throughout the country, have never been given a ticket home. They could move back into their homes if, you know, they were fixed up a bit. Meanwhile, condo developers, hotel developers are saying, you know, we want this precious land. So that's happening. The biggest public hospital in New Orleans, Charity Hospital, which is the hospital that treats many of the uninsured, is also still boarded up. The public school system has been radically restructured so that New Orleans is now, in the words of the New York Times, the leading laboratory for the conversion from the public system to the charter school system. So here you have the situation where the disaster itself was created by this ideological project of starving out the public sphere. And then that disaster is harnessed and exploited to just destroy the remaining public institutions, the schools, the hospitals, the housing projects.
You've described a philosophy that is exceptionally dark and seems to counter any sense of natural human compassion. How should we understand then what holds this group together that you say believes in disaster capitalism and a shock doctrine? Are we talking about mutual interests of profit? And who does this? Is this like, are you talking about a group of them?
I don't think it is about a group of them. I think it's simply the mania for rapid growth. I think we have an economic system that is addicted to short-term profits, and that needs that goes from one frontier to the next of super profits. And I think that it's gone on for so long that really the last frontier is these things that are so fundamental to the state. I mean, we've privatized so much else that really what's left is security, disaster response, healthcare, and war itself. So policing, fire, I mean, it's really a kind of cannibalistic stage where this addiction to growth requires this devouring of what actually makes a society functional.
But we live in a society that is, in many ways, democratic. So who's letting this happen?
I think the whole point of the shock doctrine is that these ideas aren't popular. That's why, you know, Milton Friedman says, only a crisis, real or perceived, produces real change. When that crisis occurs, the change will depend on the ideas that are lying around. So there's two things that are important in that statement. One is an admission that without a crisis, you know, during a normal democratic life, there's too much resistance to these ideas to impose them. So it's an admission that that democracy, non-apocalyptic reality, is hostile to this set of ideas. And then this notion that you need ideas that are lying around. Well, that's what think tanks are for. You know, they're ready. They're sort of ideas warmer. They stockpile ideas the way some people stockpile canned goods and water for when the next disaster hits.
So is the Chicago school a model essentially then anti-democratic? Is that what you're telling us?
Yes, it is.
Your critics are going to call you anti-American. They're going to go at you. Are you ready for it?
Yeah, I feel pretty shock resistant after all of this process. And you know what? The anti-American thing, what I'm trying to do with this book is take it beyond a nation state, beyond Bush and Cheney, beyond the sort of bad apple theory, and say, it is about an ideology. It's about a set of ideas. We shouldn't feel hopeless about it, because in fact, if we look at the past 35 years, what we see is that we never really wanted this in the first place. So I feel that this should give, you know, Canadians who tell pollsters again and again that they cherish their public institutions, that they, that public health care is a major part of what defines us as Canadians, that we believe in the CBC. You know, at the same time as we get this sort of ideological bombardment telling us that we're wrong, and that people, that, you know, that we are, you know, against the tide of history, that in fact these ideas have been opposed at every stage, and that they've sort of been shocked into implementation. So I feel like that should give us quite a lot of courage.
Naomi Klein, thank you.
Thank you so much, Anne-Maria.
Naomi Klein is a Canadian journalist, filmmaker, and author. Her new book is The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. You are listening to The Current on CBC Radio 1 and on Sirius Satellite Radio 137. I'm Anna Maria Tremonti. Well, as one might imagine, there is some disagreement on this idea of a shock doctrine. My next guests are going to discuss the arguments laid out by Naomi Klein. Joining me first in our Toronto studio is Orrell Brown. He is a professor of political science and international relations at Trinity College, University of Toronto. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning.
Well, you just heard my conversation with Naomi Klein about her book, The Shock Doctrine. What's your view of her thesis and the argument she has laid out?
She's articulate and she's provocative and she is a talented writer, but her thesis is somewhat disappointing. There's really nothing new about it. We've heard elements of this in various forms or other, all the way back to Marx or Gramsci, or more recently to Habermas, and they were expressed in a far more sophisticated and cogent way and involved thorough analysis of certain aspects of capitalism. She concatenates a variety of factors, confuses cause and effect, and brings in a kind of simplistic analysis that doesn't really rise far above the level of conspiracy theory. When she talks about psychiatry and economics and Milton Friedman, especially in the case of economics, she exhibits a remarkable degree of economic illiteracy. Milton Friedman talked about a quantitative theory of money, about monetarism as an alternative to Keynesianism. And that in itself was not entirely new. I mean, Keynesianism was challenged by the Austrian School of Economics. It was challenged by people like Hayek before it was challenged by Milton Friedman. And there were many people who were dissatisfied with the stagnation that resulted in various elements of Keynesian economics. When she comes to Eastern Europe, she creates this kind of weird stew where she confuses what happened there. She calls a counter-revolution against Keynesianism. That is not at all what happened in Russia or in Eastern Europe. You looked at failed communism, failed Marxism-Leninism. There was no clear roadmap. It was a way of trying to get these countries back on track. If you look at Czechoslovakia in 1938, Czechoslovakia in 1938 as a market economy was one of the most advanced states in the world, among the top five. It had a per capita GDP higher than that of Germany.
Well,
by 1990, it was a miserable failure. It had to be changed. There was the pain of transition.
But when you talk about getting countries back on track, she looks at Russia and makes the point that getting Russia back on track was about handing the country's riches to a handful of very powerful men. It wasn't about giving the country back to the people at all.
In Russia, the change was nowhere nearly as successful as it was in Eastern Europe. If you look at transition, the successful states, the most successful were Czechoslovakia, which became the Czech and the Slovak Republic, Poland and Hungary, and today we see vibrant economies that are part of the European Union. Russia took a number of wrong turns. In fact, Yegor Gaidar, who was blamed for shock therapy, was advised by Jeffrey Sachs, never got to implement what was called shock therapy. Things began to go wrong. There was no ruble stabilization. It was a complex situation where there were cultural factors, where there was an incomplete political change, where there was an unwillingness to move. But one of the lessons in Eastern Europe, what she called shock therapy, was that in a sense it was counterintuitive. Everything was falling apart. There was incredible inefficiency. In fact, the Czech economy that I was talking about, which was so advanced by 1990, was performing below the level of that of Chile. It was that far back. It was one of the poorest countries in Europe when you compare it to Western Europe. And so the essence here was to move at all levels. And what was shown was that the more quickly you move, the more effective it was, because it was invariable pain. You cannot make those changes painlessly. No one could do it. There was such a disaster created by Marxism-Leninism.
Well, let me ask you, you mentioned Chile. What about the idea that the followers of the Chicago School, as part of their economic model, call for a type of crisis, natural or created, in other countries where they want to perform their radical and sweeping economic changes, like Chile in 73, sure. Like Iraq?
And you need to be prepared for a crisis, to what she claims is a longing for a crisis, where she talks about these radical ideological warriors, these economists from Chicago, trained at the University of Chicago, going off and trying to engage in some sort of radical change. In Chile, Pinochet clearly was engaged in horrific criminal activities. No one disputes that. But the Chilean economy under Allende was a disaster. The nationalization program had failed. There was hyperinflation. And when you look at Chile today, Chile has a vibrant economy, and those who had succeeded Pinochet, the democratic leaders have succeeded Pinochet, have not chosen to go back to the Marxist economics of Allende. They have continued that economic transformation. So were these radical ideological warriors, or were these people who proposed alternate solutions to Keynesian economics? And in many cases, those solutions worked. In some instances, it did not work that well. So it's not a kind of conspiracy, this shock doctrine, where you have a kind of ideological group of conspirators who are looking for crisis, or she somehow seems to hint that they are trying to generate crisis where they say, well, okay, now we have Iraq, this kind of economic determinism. There's a chance to make vast profits for Halliburton and others. But then looking at the complexity of what had happened in Iraq, where you had a leader who was genocidal, who was responsible for the deaths of more than 1 million Iraqis, who had been engaged in this vast theft of oil for food money, who had impoverished his people, who had engaged in mass torture, who had a Baathist party that employed thousands of torturers who couldn't be left in, where there had to be some sort of de-Baathification.
Why, when they move in an economic program in Iraq, do they say 100% of your oil profits can be taken out of the country? Why would you do that in a country that, as you just point out, was impoverished by its own leader? Why would you do that?
You know, when you look at foreign investments, there are instances where investments can generate profits that can be taken out of the country. In other cases, cannot. In the case of Iraq, Bremer was viewed as a failure, and it was not a particularly good economic policy. But to say that this is why the Americans went in, that this is what Iraq was about, that this was not a case of someone who had threatened the entire region, someone, Saddam Hussein, who had caused utter disaster for his own people, who had taken over, conquered Kuwait, and murdered thousands of people, and to say, well, this was some sort of economic plot where basically what they wanted to do was to create a situation where Halliburton can profit, that doesn't rise above the level of conspiracy.
Okay, Oral Brown, I want you to stay with us. I want to bring Greg Palast into this discussion. He is a journalist, an author, and someone who studied economics at the Chicago School under Milton Friedman. He joins us from West Hampton Beach, New York this morning. Hello.
Good morning.
Well, you did study under Milton Friedman. Does Naomi Klein's thesis ring true with your experience of him and the rest of the Chicago boys?
I think that she was way too polite. This was a group of people that was completely dangerous. I was one of the few Americans within the Chicago boys training group. And let me tell you, they thought that Chile was a democracy under Pinochet. They had a great glee and joy in the bloodbath and moved in, and they privatized the assets, mainly turning them to their own private interests. Like the electric company was literally purchased for pennies by one of the Chicago boys who kept it for himself. Their idea of privatization is they keep it. And by the way, I heard the phrase conspiracy theory twice in Mr. Brown's discussion, which is a good way to smear a very brilliant and important exposition by Naomi. And let's go into the facts here. First of all, if you look at the plans, for example, for Ecuador by the World Bank and IMF, it included, say, look, we have to change this economy around, dollarize the economy, get rid of the local currency and privatize everything, cut pensions, and this will, quote, cause social unrest. These are from confidential documents from the World Bank. Quote, social unrest, which will require a, quote, strong government response. I went through these documents with Joe Stiglitz, the chief economist of the World Bank. He said it's exactly the code words that you know exactly what they mean. It's they know that you will create plans, harsh economic plans, which will cause a riot, which will require tanks in the street, and the tanks in the street will then impose the new economic policy. Yes, crisis is absolutely part of the plan.
Now, the other point that she makes is that she talks about torture as a required part of the shock doctrine and that it looks to accomplish these economic changes. I'd like to get both of you to weigh in on that. We could just start with you, Greg Palast.
Yeah, Chile, by the way, was the model for Iraq. You know, the model for Iraq was drafted substantially under the guidance of the top corporate lobbyist in America, a guy named Grover Norquist. When I talked to him about it, when I discovered this, he said, look, our model was Chile. Their idea of democracy is what they call property rights. He said, you privatize first. There's steps you take first before you hold an election. They got resistance. The privatizers and the economic shockers got resistance from General Jay Gardner, who was the first man that Bush put in charge in Iraq, because he called for elections. And they said no elections. As Norquist, the lobbyist, said, there are certain things which must come before elections. And in particular, in the case of Paul Bremer, you had 100 diktats orders which entirely changed the economy of Iraq to a free market, free fire, free for all.
Now, I want you to speak specifically to the torture issue, though, because we're running out of time.
Well, you can't take it away from the economic issue. For example, one of the phrases in the report is privatize all state assets, especially in the oil industry. And as Garner said, you can't do that unless you shoot people, and that's what they did.
Oral Brown, what do you think?
That's what you got to do.
What do you think?
Well, talk about conspiracy theories. I mean, everything is something secret.
Wait, Jay Garner? No. I will not allow that type of... No. Actually, you...
Well, you can talk over me, or you can allow me the courtesy to speak.
Okay, you know what? No. Greg Palast, let's let him finish, and then you can respond. Go ahead.
All right. Enough with the conspiracy theory stuff, though, okay?
This gentleman talks to the chief economist of the World Bank. Well, there's a conspiracy within the World Bank to create violence in Ecuador. The model in the case of Iraq is to be that of Chile. Incidentally, I think George Bush would be incredibly happy if in the end Iraq would wind up a stable democracy like Chile. That's one of the most successful economies in Latin America. But this kind of economic determinism then tied to the notion of torture, that this is somehow built in. And when you look at the theories of Milton Friedman, who talked about and wrote about freedom. I mean, Friedman didn't just talk about economics. He wrote about capitalism and freedom, and he wrote a book which was a bestseller, Free to Choose, which emphasized the notion of individual dignity and of freedom. And to tie this in with torture is not only sordid, but it's so distorted that it just discredits this kind of analysis. And I'm afraid if we don't rise above the notion that, yes, there are mistakes, and yes, there may be nefarious characters on occasion, there may be bad policies, but this is not the be-all and end-all of policy, that there are other goals, that there are multiple factors, and that we look at various causes, and we try to find what causality is in order to improve the situation, we are not going to have a better world. We are just going to have a very fearful world that is trapped in its own paranoia, and that will not move us anywhere close to what I think most people like to see, a more equitable and decent international system.
So you don't see these things as interconnected, Greg Palast? Do you
they
see them
interconnected? You cannot sell off all the state enterprises and put literally half of the Iraqi economy of the people of Iraq out of work, and then not have to control them through the force of violence. Same with Chile. Same with Ecuador. And they know this will happen. They prepare it to happen because they prepare the military plans in parallel with the economic plans.
Well, Oral Brown, why don't you speak to that? He's making the point. How do you do this without violence if you take people's country away from them?
Well, this is the assumption that there was peace in Iraq right after the Americans went in, that there was reconciliation between the Sunnis and the Shiites, and the Kurds were all happy. We are looking at a situation in Iraq where there are also ethnic and religious tensions, where you had people like Muqtada al-Sadr, who immediately tried to create an empire for himself in Sadr City and other parts of Iraq, where there's violence almost from the very beginning.
But she makes the point that there were actual elections in some of those places, and it was the United States who said those elections are null and void, and then the violence rose from the lack of the freedom of elections.
That is not exactly the sequence. There were elections, but elections have to be organized. You can't just say, look, we don't have any institutions, we don't have any processes, we're just going to have some elections. It is the responsibility of any power, as the United States, as the Western powers did in Germany, as they did in Japan, as they did in Italy, that there has to be a progression. And one of the great criticisms, in fact, of Iraq has been that far from this kind of neat conspiratorial set of policies where they want to grab the economy, where they just wanted to do away with the Ba'ath regime, the Americans were utterly disorganized. They really had no plan, that it was a mess, that Paul Bremer was an utter incompetent, and that all those forces underneath in Iraq, which in some ways was an artificial construct, were allowed to rise to the fore, engage in what now is an extraordinarily nasty civil war. So what I'm arguing is that we need to look at multiple factors. We can't just engage in this kind of reductionist arguments where we just say, look, let's feed our fears of the United States, that of capitalism, and that of change.
Oral Brown, Greg Palast, we have to leave it there. Thank you both for weighing in on this issue. I've been speaking with Oral Brown. He's a professor of political science and international relations at Trinity College at the University of Toronto. He was in our Toronto studio. Greg Palast is a journalist and the author of Armed Madhouse from Baghdad to New Orleans and a former student of economics under Milton Friedman. He was in West Hampton Beach, New York. Stay with CBC Radio 1 this morning. Sounds like Canada is next. It begins a series looking at some of the problems and successes unique to the fastest growing group in the country, Aboriginal Canadians. I'm Anna Maria Tremonti. Thank you for listening to The Current.